Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And in our appeals to heaven, we need to continue to learn and understand what it is we have to fight, what we're trying to actually obtain. The better we understand, the better we articulate in our prayers as we make our appeals to heaven. So let's learn, pray, and act. Now, we are focused on Constitution Day and the whole Constitution. It's always about the entire Constitution. We have a color-coded Constitution that identifies the violations to the Constitution. We also have a color-coded Constitution that identifies what each line of the Constitution is. Is this a power? If it's a power, that means Congress has the ability to alter or make a law regarding it. Now, we knew going through the Constitutional Convention that there were specific things that they could not change. As a matter of fact, Sean, welcome back. It is the day we cut our teeth in reading the Constitution. Welcome.
Can't wait to get started.
Ah, okay. I'm sure there's a lot of people who would, shut up, GR, and let's start reading. So, I have to say this, that when this nation was being formed, it was formed under the pressures and the oppression of tyranny coming from England. In 1763, when the king made the decision to actually, you know, take their flesh out of the colonists, take their pound of flesh in taxation to pay for his war games and his tyranny, most people didn't know that as we started rebelling and pushing back, he was literally considering expanding the role of the West Indies Trading Company to actually start managing the Americas as well. The West Indies Trading Company was the company that was kind of managing basically, you know, India, the Chinese markets, and so forth. This is how they were controlling their commerce with the rest of the world. So as we were looking, and they were very heavy-handed, these were the guys that killed a whole bunch of Chinese when they were running opium into China so that they could get their tea. It was opium for tea. The emperor or whoever was in charge of China, the premier, whatever, he basically pushed back with Britain and says, we want you to pay us in silver. This opium is killing us. We need to stop the flow of opium into China. And the West Indies Trading Company says, oh, you want us to stop? And then they just took battleships up the Guangzhou and all these different rivers where they were doing these trade exchange and just blew up the villages. I mean, just death and carnage. And said, you'll take opium and you'll give us green tea. And there we understand now how China learned how to be such cutthroats and how to understand how to destroy a nation, because they were literally destroyed by the British Empire by actually running opium into them. So why wouldn't China want to be running fentanyl into America? They learned the devastation of what happens to a nation that is being crippled in such a way. So to be clear, folks, As I lay out the history, we've covered this history from the beginning, from the Tory Acts into the Articles of Association, into the Articles of Confederation. At every step of the way, until the Continental Congress said we need to have a convention for the Constitution, every step of the way, America was having to deal with problems. We didn't have the tranquility and the level of peace that we had in the Constitutional Convention. Now that they had the best and brightest minds to go and set aside time to literally discuss how to improve the government that was about to fail, because the Articles of Confederation were about to fail. So as they discussed this over the course of several meetings at Annapolis and so forth, they finally decided we're going to have a convention in 1787, and it's going to start in May, and it'll go into no longer than September. And so they set it out to go fix the Articles of Federation. They did so in peace, and not only in peace, but in, I'll just say, in communion with the Creator, the divine hand of providence. And so as they started to pray and they started to unify as a body of men working to save this government and this beautiful opportunity of liberty that they achieved at the spilling of blood, sanctifying the concept of liberty by the spilling of blood, the divine hand of providence poured out his spirit and gave them a constitution and guided them in creating a governance for mankind. This was the Creator's version of globalism, so that all people and all nations would have the full sovereignty necessary to make their own decisions, choose what you want to eat, choose what you want to do, how to provide for your family. You had full sovereignty. No other nation ever had what we were given out of that Constitutional Convention. This is why I tell people that we have the scriptures to help us understand God's law. But God gave us a governing system to allow us to actually become a free nation, to where not only do we have a free market, but we have a free exchange of ideas and a free exchange of the concepts of how to worship, where we could truly flourish in our individual relationships with Christ, where we wouldn't have the governing of churches as all nations prior to America had been basically in the thralls of monarchies and so forth, and basically in coupled with theocracies. The concept of a single magistrate government system and a theocracy entwined with it was destroyed under this Constitution. And therefore, when we look at the scriptures and the Ten Commandments, technically, those scriptures that follow outside of God's law, the scriptures help everybody understand how to live that law. What do we have for the Constitution? Our scriptures to the Constitution are the ratification debates. This is where it is clearly delineated and clearly defined, and it even becomes legally bound, because as they stipulated what these lines meant, this is exactly what they meant, and nobody could reinterpret these things. This is why Madison was so consistent. This is why I pointed this out yesterday. And we're going to point this out in other documents. So moving forward and going into this Constitution, this is our Creator's plan of globalism. This is why in Article 4, Section 3, new states can join the Union. It didn't limit to only states within the North American or the Western Hemisphere. There were no bounds placed on what state could join the Union. Even though in the early days they weren't going to take on monarchies and so forth, I believe that as the world has seen the experience and the experiment of this sovereign nations of nations, we can see that most states, and I think most people, that's why they want to come to America, because of liberty. And I believe that we can begin transitioning the world to become a part of this union. We just have to basically put asunder all of these other forms of globalism from the World Bank, the UN, and so forth. Those are Satan's way of subjugating the world and forcing them into global communism, where we actually offer the people liberty. And I believe that this is what people want. And we've constrained the world from being able to come into America. Not that the Constitution doesn't allow it. We benefit by allowing the manipulation and the building of regimes and so forth. And this is how America and the globalists have blood on their hands, because they haven't followed the Constitution. And so with that, that's kind of my setup of how important this Constitution is. And this is why on Constitution Day, we want to kick off the reading of the entire Constitution for you. So whatever that takes, regardless of the discussions, I don't want to get to a point, you know, 4 weeks down the road to say, hey, we're only halfway through. We need to take the time that is necessary. I don't think we necessarily need to take that much time, especially the way we're going to be focused and getting the content covered more rapidly. In other words, every day we're going to be reading the Constitution. Constitution, is kind of like that little line in the Brady Bunch. Marcia, Marcia, Marcia. I hope that people relish the opportunity to hear these words and to basically hear how these words were described, what these words really meant, and how they were, you know, defined in the ratification debate. So with that, Sean, Sean and I are using the violations, the color-coded violations of the Constitution in reading this. And so it is our hope that we maintain this cognitive understanding of what we're reading and letting you know that this first line, the next line, this whole clause, this is being violated. And the reason we want to do this is because we want you to understand how it's being violated. We don't want to just tell you it's being violated. This is one of the important things about using color codes. We're showing you that this line is being violated. Understanding, so you can tell people, you know, see this line right here? It's identified as lying or being violated. This is how it's being violated. Now we're truly teaching you not just the Constitution, what it means, but how it's being violated. And when people start understanding the magnitude of the violations we're basically being thrown under, it is an indictment of the tyranny that we're living with. Anyway, with that, anything to add, Sean? You want to add anything?
No, sir.
Okay. That's great. Awesome. Just in the future, by all means, if I haven't opened it up and offered, because I do get favorable comment when people actually, you know, want to contribute or what have you. So in the future, if you think of something, by all means, interrupt or, you know, just say, hey, can I say something? Can I ask something? Whatever. So moving forward, I want them to know that I've given you the keys to inject.
Thank you, sir.
No problem. Thank you. Okay, so Article 1, Section 1. And it's obvious that the very first part of this line is identifying it's being violated. So let's go ahead and read this first clause of Article 1, Section 1.
All legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in a Congress of the United States.
Okay, don't read the whole thing, though.
Which shall consist of a Senate and House of Representatives.
Okay, just to make sure that everybody knows what Congress means, it is the Senate and the House of Representatives. It's not the Supreme Court. It's not the executive, the president, and his, you know, his executive bureaucracies or his executive departments, the State Department, the Treasury, and the War Department. Those were the three departments that were necessary for the federal government to function. That was it. Those three departments. In this Constitution, the framers understood that they needed to have a treasury to focus on the taxation and the paying of the taxes or paying of debt and so forth. The State Department was the foreign interfacing, as well as with the commerce and as well as the naturalization, the responsibilities that they had that wouldn't be covered under the Treasury. And then the War Department, their responsibility was to be prepared to form the militia into a federalized army and to maintain the Navy and to keep that, and having strategies, what to do, how to respond, so forth. So anyway, the part that's absolutely being violated is all legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in Congress of the United States, which means only Congress can create law. There is no amendment to this to allow the Supreme Court to sit on their, you know, on their high horses or sitting from upon high and pontificate and basically create law, interpret the law, and tell us what the law means. They do not have that authority. They do not have that authority in this Constitution. They have assumed the ability to interpret, create law, and so forth. And that goes the same with the president. The president has been using executive powers to force or to create law. And he's been signing off on all these things. And as a matter of fact, with the, as I stated on Monday, with the assassination of Charlie Kirk, you know, the rancor and the overreach is going to only increase by this president. Now, everybody that listens to the show may like what Trump is doing because it is favorable to the paradigm of conservative, moral. But what he's doing, the question must always be presented. One, does he have the authority to do that, to create that law? And two, are those laws that he is creating, those things that he's actually doing as a law, are they in pursuant to the Constitution, or is he assuming laws that are not in pursuance to the Constitution? Let's see, he finally was granted the ability to create a law. Is he doing it because that power exists within the Constitution, or are they arbitrary laws because he thinks that's what America needs? And it's always the latter, never the former. Same thing with the courts. This is why power to create law was vested in our Republican form of government. It was vested in our representatives. Other Republican forms of government, like the Communist China, they're Republican in form, but the power is vested in a very small body and into the president of whatever you want to call Z, whatever his post is, his title. They and he have very extreme general powers to do whatever they want to do. The same with every other country in the world. Only America do we have this thing called separations of powers. So, let's go into Article 1, Section 2, and let's just read the first paragraph here.
The House of Representatives shall be composed of members chosen every second year by the people of the several states, and the electors in each state shall have the qualifications requisite for electors of the most numerous branch of the state legislature.
Okay, so what that means is that there's this body of men that will be selected by the people. And the electors in each state shall have the qualifications requisite for electors of the most numerous branch. In other words, when you look at the state or the Congress and the House of Representatives, why would they refer to them as electors of the most numerous branch of the state legislature? So when the Electoral College cannot select a president, how is the president chosen? After the Electoral College kind of fails, what happens? Do you know?
Even the House of Representatives,
yes,
and the Senate.
No, so it's the House of Representatives.
House of Representatives, they have one vote per state, and it's for.
Yes.
They have to vote whoever is the majority.
Excellent. So, in other words, if the Electoral College fails, it goes to the House of Representatives as the electors of the president. So, in other words, there's this duality. We want to actually create, and the intent behind the electors was to run a campaign for the president throughout the states. So each congressional district would have one elector running a campaign, and you would choose the elector who would be basically campaigning for the president that you wanted. So you would select him. Instead, you know, if you want Washington, you'd select Washington's elector instead of John Adams. Instead of people chose the elector who was campaigning for President Washington. Now, we've gone through this because of the ambiguity here in the Constitution. Most people thought that the state legislature would then be able to choose the electors. However, when we go through the Continental Congress Convention, and then when we go through the ratification debates, it's very clear that the electors were to be chosen by the people, just like the representatives, that we would actually choose our representative as well as our elector, because the two may not meet. You may actually want to have a president that is very fiscally sound and want to have a very liberal representative in Congress, because you want him to be able to do things, but we still want to have a president that kind of has this focus on, you know. So in other words, this is where you actually would have separate interests for a president versus a representative. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Okay.
I mean, it's like, what was it? I was trying to think of an example of where they had Democrats for this, Democrats for Reagan, or Republicans for Clinton, or kind of like that thing.
Yes, you'd have some crossover when it came to parties. But back in those days, they didn't have parties. The parties didn't actually start, or I should say, a separate... Let me correct myself. There were parties. There was the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists. And so after the Constitution was ratified in this new government, most elections were being handled by the, you know, or I should say, if there were parties, it was the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists. In 1792, though, we will go through the document of how Madison and Jefferson stood up the Republican Party in response to Hamilton and his concept of implied powers, because they knew that was going to end up biting them. And they created the Republican Party, but they didn't do much with it. In other words, they didn't put a lot of effort in building the party throughout the states and so forth. But that was in 1792, was when they had this idea that they needed to have a third party. And that third party actually came into play in 1799. When they said, okay, if these guys are going to give us tyranny coming from the presidency, then we're going to oust them, and that's what they ended up doing. But anyway, so let's read the second paragraph of Section 2.
No person shall be a representative who shall not have attained to the age of 25 years and been 7 years a citizen of the United States, and who shall not, when elected, be an inhabitant of that state in which he shall be chosen.
In other words, they have to, one, live in that state, right? They have to be living in the state, as well as they have to be a citizen of the United States for 7 years. If you're going to be in a federal position, you actually have to naturalize as a citizen. Okay? So, actually, and at this point in time, because they had this, you know, this, I'll just say, this favorable period, that most everybody during the Continental Congress and the age of the Articles of Confederation, most everybody was considered citizens of the United States. If you were serving in the militia, you were a citizen of the United States. That was a little U back in those days, but under the United States or under the Constitution, they made it a capital U because it was truly a United States. Little U being united with very limited scope under the Articles of Confederation, under the Articles of Association. So that's why the capital U becomes important. Most people keep on using the little U, but that's incorrect. Some people even say that the Constitution had, the original Constitution had a little U. No, it did not. It had a capital U. The Declaration of Independence had a little U. Anyway, so... The same application to the electors stands, because that's what it said. The electors for president shall have the same qualifications as the House of Representatives. Now let's go into the next part of that.
Representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states, modified by Amendment 16, which may be included within this union according to their respective numbers, which shall be determined by adding to the whole number of the free persons, including those bound to service for a term of years, and excluding Indians not taxed, 3/5 of all other persons.
Right. So we're going into a break right here. So what we want to do at this point is kind of digest this. We'll come back because there's more to this part, but actually I think at this point we'll kind of explain, you know, how these things were modified, but more importantly, that this very first part that Sean read, these are being violated and how they're being violated. So anyway, we'll be right back after this short promo. Thank you so much.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so this is a clause, or I should say a stanza, a paragraph in the Constitution that has these codependent components. The very first part talks about apportionment, how the states will receive representation in the House of Representatives, as well as how they're taxed. This is why the 16th Amendment changes this apportionment, because direct taxes were no longer going to be based on census given to the states, apportioned to the states. In other words, the states no longer are to be taxed by the federal government. The 16th Amendment gave the federal government the ability to, and I'll just dive down to it real quick, because there's a lot of people think that there's a ghost here, but there's not. Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes on incomes from whatever source derived without apportionment. The several taxes and without apportionment among the several states and without regard to any census or enumeration. So in other words, the direct tax or the duty tax was basically laid out initially to the states based on population. Now, instead, they were going to start, all it said was it is no longer based on apportionment. Did you hear me say, or did you hear the 16th Amendment say that it could tax one individual differently than another individual? Did you hear that, Sean?
No, sir.
Okay.
I did not.
All right, so here's the gold nugget. In the laying out of taxes, how they basically changed this part of the Constitution, section Article 1, Section 2, as well as Article 1, Section 8, that preamble that Congress should have the power to lay, direct taxes and so forth and so on. In the very last clause of that preamble, it says that it shall be uniform throughout the Union. In other words, the uniform requirement still was to be maintained. The federal government could not target states, individual states, or even individual people to create winners and losers or providing preference. Oh, you don't make any income, we're not going to tax you. They had to have, and they had to apply, a uniform tax to all citizens because the uniformity clause demanded it. But instead, this is how the 16th Amendment actually violates the Constitution, because the way they applied it was not uniform. Now, when we're looking at Section 2 and this very beginning part, they're talking about how the apportionment is to be laid out. And it talks about the 16th Amendment saying it gets rid of that. But the one thing you mentioned before we went into break, that this is actually was modified by the 14th Amendment. When you read in here, does it say anything in this yellow clause, or the yellow highlighted part? Do you see the words citizen of the United States?
No, sir.
No, it does not. In other words, the inhabitants of the several states, whether you were a citizen or not, the census basically kept track, and it would identify citizens and inhabitants, you know, immigrants, you know, visitors, what have you. And so that they were to only count for heads, persons, right? Correct?
Number of free persons.
Yep, a number of free persons. However, when we read the 14th Amendment, Section 2, it says this: representatives shall be apportioned among the several states according to their respective numbers, counting the whole number of persons of each state, excluding Indians not taxed. But when the right to vote of an election for choice of electors for president and vice president of the United States, representatives in Congress and executives and judicial officers of a state, the members of the legislature thereof is denied to any male inhabitants of said state between 21 years of age and citizens of the United States. That's the kicker right there. The 14th Amendment basically says you have to make sure that you allow citizens of the United States the ability to vote. Today, the apportionment is being granted to illegals. Apportionment is being granted to states that are, because the census in 1980, Jimmy Carter, with his backhand, swiped and basically insulted and created this huge advantage for people to start bringing illegals here to bolster their party line in getting these people to vote their line, and basically saying we're going to count these people as apportionment, and that opened the door to say, well, we're going to even let them vote. When the Constitution, and we go through all of this, the Constitution is clear, the only people that have the right to vote in America for federal elections regarding federal apportionment, everything else, for their federal representatives, have to be U.S. citizens. They must be U.S. citizens. So this became a huge attack on watering down, you know, our elections by allowing non-citizens to be counted and to be apportioned and for voting, all three. And so this is how most people, when you look at this one clause, you go, well, hold on, how is that really being violated? And it's right there, because it dives into this, you know, who can actually be voting. And in the 14th Amendment, it delineated this even further, and it expounded. This was the only amendment, the 14th Amendment, Section 2, is the only amendment that actually talks and touches this apportionment process and says, hey, if a state wants to play the games, because at this point in time, the southern states were actually taking away the ability for freemen, free blacks, after the 14th Amendment, or after the 13th Amendment, after all these blacks were supposedly free, if a state was going to deny them the ability to vote, then they were to take a loss. They couldn't count those heads based on that. In other words, if they had a law that said blacks, then in the census, they would remove or adjust their apportionment for representation, taking away those counts. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Okay, good. Good.
It's punitive action.
Yes, so it, correct.
Very, it be applicable to the current situation, like in California, where they have illegals who are not citizens that are being granted voting rights and being counted in the census for apportionment?
No, absolutely. So the concept of counting illegals, counting immigrants as a part of representation. Let's be clear here. When new states were joining the Union, Congress allowed the new state to send a representative, at least one representative in the, both the House and in the Senate, to be there so that they can hear what's going on and so they can be kind of involved, but they would not be able to vote. They had to be in the Union before they could even vote in Congress.
We still have that today, don't we?
Well, they still, so yeah, they have Puerto Rico and these other places, and they give them far more privileges than they should be getting. And D.C. now actually does have electors. D.C. should not have electors. They should not have representation in Congress. But they do. And they're trying to get statehood. So this is where, you know, this is where they, you know, if you can make a charge, you know, to attack the federal government, you want to get all hands or as many possible, you know, culprits into the government that we possibly can so that we can start undermining it. And that's exactly what they started doing. And that's exactly what Jimmy Carter did. And most people, they don't look at Jimmy Carter, oh, well, he kind of had bad inflation. No, no, this guy was actually doing all sorts of things that were literally unconstitutional. We have to understand that even Reagan was doing things that he had no constitutional authority to do. Even though they may have been probably very good intentioned, like Reagan was huge on putting teeth into equal employment. Reagan wanted to make sure that, you know, blacks weren't being disparaged for housing, for employment, and so forth. So he bolstered up the EEO, and he bolstered up this, you know, making sure that blacks were, you know, having a fair shake throughout the United States by bolstering up this bureaucracy. That was Reagan that did that. Carter didn't do anything to do that. Why? Because the Democrats are predominantly racist. And so when somebody's going to do something, when you can't do it unless we have the constitutional authority, which is why the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was unconstitutional. They didn't need to do it. All they needed to do was enforce the Constitution. The problem was the Supreme Court went into the 14th Amendment and redefined it to allow this Plessy v. Ferguson rule of equal but separate. You know, with this concept of, well, as long as they have a place to sit, it doesn't have to be necessarily equal, but as long as it's, you know, they have a place to sit, you know, on a train, it's in the very back, and then maybe, you know, maybe a cargo. It may not have any nice comforts or anything, treating these people like trash. As long as they have a place, then equal, separate but equal. The whole concept of the separate but equal clause was to allow them to actually create more discrimination. It's the same thing with everything that the Supreme Court has done regarding the 14th Amendment. That's why most people look at the 14th Amendment as this evil, evil amendment. No, it's only evil because the court unconstitutionally redefined it. So anyway, let's get back to this, this clause, though. So the actual enumeration, go ahead and pick it up from there.
I had, and this might be an aside, was the 16th Amendment actually ratified officially? Because I've heard rumor and seen different things that it wasn't correctly ratified,
so,
the 16th Amendment.
So the real question is, and that's a good question, was the 16th Amendment constitutionally ratified? Because we're counting it as it is. That's the same thing with the 13th Amendment of 1812. We actually have evidence that the 13th Amendment was ratified, it was carried into law, and they actually were, you know, living under that 13th Amendment for a long time because it goes into the Wyoming compiled laws of the state of Wyoming or the territory of Wyoming in 1871 or in the early 1870s, and they listed that 13th Amendment as a part of the laws of the land. So we have evidence that the 13th Amendment was ratified. We have evidence that there's possibly a, you know, improper ratification of the 16th and 17th Amendments. We even have evidence that the First Amendment of the Bill of Rights was actually ratified by Connecticut. And had they actually ratified it properly, it would be counted today. And therefore, this upcoming violation would, you know, actually be even more visible, the importance of this, because we're going to get into this upcoming one. But the question is, how do we determine this? The only way we can actually shake everything loose is we actually have to have a full audit based in the states. So each state, when they conduct republic review, they'll actually have to go through their books formally to declare whether the 16th and 17th Amendments were or were not properly ratified. The question is, did they cover their tracks to make sure that there was no discovery? Now, one of the things we found out about the 16th Amendment, and I believe the 17th Amendment, because they were both done at the same time, that Oregon did not seat their incoming, because by the time those amendments went out for ratification, Oregon did not have their representatives sworn in. They weren't in session. So they were going to ratify those amendments in the next session. So when the election occurred, because it was an election year, when the election occurred in the fall, many of the, I'll just say, the racist or those progressives that wanted, who were basically pursuing to the ratification of the 16th and 17th Amendments, they were elected out. In other words, there was enough, you know, changing of the seats in the state legislature that it was not going to pass. They actually, there were campaigns that were being ran. Do you want to have income tax? Do you want this to happen to you? And so they actually voted in kind to change the makeup of the state legislature. Why is this such a long story? When they seated the new representatives, they actually didn't. Instead, they allowed the old representatives, those old representatives should have been sworn out, or actually, new representatives should have been sworn in prior to the session. That's how it's done every time. Oregon, the government of Oregon, chose not to swear them in, to allow the representatives of the old session to come in, though they were not elected, to come in and vote on the amendments, because they said, oh, well, it happened in their session, so they should be the ones to vote on it. And it created this huge uproar.
And yeah, because they're no longer the representatives.
That's right. Absolutely. So we know that in that particular case, it didn't count. But the question is, was that enough, or was there any other shenanigans in other states? And Bill, I believe it's Bob Bennett, I think his name's Bob Bennett, who wrote a book about this, the 16th and 17th Amendments, how they were questionably ratified. And so I'm all in favor of getting to the truth. But the only way we'll actually be able to do it is we have to force this to happen. And before we can even get our state legislature to do that, we got to get our state legislatures to demand full compliance of the Constitution. And the only way to do that is to get our counties to demand full compliance of the Constitution of our state legislature. So we, the people, have to start at the county level, building constitutional compliance committees and so forth, and start creating counties on the path of becoming constitutional. And so this is all, you know, why counties matter most, and my upcoming article will get into all of this. But, folks, the only way we're going to fix this is you got to get involved. You know, I'm just preaching. Doesn't matter what it doesn't matter what I say. It matters what you do. So, anyway, let's go ahead then. Did that answer your question?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Thank you.
So let's pick up the actual enumeration, and we'll kind of read all of this through, and then I'll jump back at the part that's actually being violated. Go ahead.
The actual enumeration shall be made within 3 years after the first meeting of the Congress of the United States, and within every subsequent term of 10 years, in such manner as they shall by law direct. The number of representatives shall not exceed one for every 30,000, but each state shall have at least one representative. And until such enumeration shall be made, the state of New Hampshire shall be entitled to choose 3, Massachusetts 8, Rhode Island and Providence Plantations 1, Connecticut 5, New York 6, New Jersey 4, Pennsylvania 8, Delaware 1, Maryland 6, Virginia 10, North Carolina 5, South Carolina 5, and Georgia 3. When vacancies happen in the representation from any state, the executive authority thereof shall issue writs of election to fill such vacancies. The House of Representatives shall choose their speaker and other officers, and shall have the sole power of impeachment.
Okay, so what you read covered kind of the standards, or, you know, how they were going to maintain the apportionment. They were going to start off with these numbers, and then in 1790 they were going to have a census. And then the states would then have to redistrict the state based on the census, the outcome of the census, how many representatives they were going to have. So that changed in the 1792 election of how the reapportionment was going to be done. Does that make sense? Because the federal government conducted the census in 1790. Then they provided the numbers out to the states. Here are the amount of people you have, because in 1790 was the second year of the session, right? 1789, then 1790 was the second year of the session of Congress. So the states had to then reapportion their congressional districts or redraw their congressional districts. So they couldn't just do that immediately. It took time to do that. So for it to affect the next election, that next election was in 1791. And so in 1791, when they elected their representatives, that's when you saw the shift of representation. Now, some states may have actually, you know, dragged their heels on it, because I think it said here, as may direct for the manner of 3 years, right? So the actual enumeration, every subsequent term, but I think that they were waiting for a three-year period for the time.
Right before.
Right. And so the point is that they wanted to pad themselves and say, okay, so if you don't get the redistricting done, it has to be done within 3 years. And so that would allow some of the initial states that had some benefits to actually, you know, change their apportionment or representation slower. So, because some of the, you know, who knows? And I would actually have to pull up the data to find out how the numbers increased, probably, because they didn't have a really good feel. They didn't really have a good census at any point in time until their very first official census was done. Does that make sense? I mean, it wasn't until 1790 where the United States government actually hired people to go out and, you know, collect the data to conduct the census. Did they get it all done in 1 year? I have no idea. But bottom line, I think there was a shift. It may have been in 1792, or it may have been a little bit later and showed up in 1794 in the following election. Either way, the point is this. The number of representatives shall not exceed one for every 30,000, but each state shall have at least one representative, and until such enumeration shall be made. In other words, unless they change that number from 30,000 to 40,000, 30,000 is fixed. This is not up to the Congress to be able to change that number. This was discussed in the Constitutional Convention. We went through this in detail in Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention, that they originally gave Congress the ability to change that number. And then it came up to go, hold on here. If we're giving Congress the ability to control how many people they're representing, then they can easily start growing that to empower them more and more and create more of an oligarchy. And we're literally living today where we almost have 1 million people represented by one person in Congress. Do you think we're being fairly represented? Do you think we have an oligarchy? Yes and yes. So Section 3 now, Section 3 is focused, Section 2 is focused on the House of Representatives. Section 3 is focused on the Senate. Okay, so let's go ahead. Let me see. We've got 4 minutes. Yeah, let's go ahead and knock out this very first paragraph here.
The Senate of the United States shall be composed of two senators from each state, chosen by the legislature thereof, modified by Amendment 17, for 6 years, and each senator shall have one vote.
Okay, now the highlighting of the words chosen by the state legislature, that is just identifying the language that changed in the 17th Amendment. So go ahead and read the next part, and you'll notice that there, the other part of the red is the other thing that they changed. The key here is, in the 17th Amendment, did the 17th Amendment change who the Senate, the senators were to represent? Are they to represent the people of the state? Because right now, under the Constitution, this original language and original definition, the senators were clearly delineated to represent the suffrage of the state legislature. In other words, they were to vote the way the state legislature told them to vote. When you look at suffrage, what is suffrage? What is woman suffrage? If I ask you that question, Sean, what is
right to vote?
Woman's right to vote, correct. So when you say black suffrage, that would be the same thing. The right for black people to vote. Or, you know, no race, and you know, it doesn't matter what your race is, every person, every U.S. citizen has the right to vote. That just means what it is. Every U.S. citizen has the right to vote. So when I say state suffrage, which means state legislator suffrage, what does that mean?
That means the state's government's input into or their right to vote.
Has a right to demand that how those votes are to be made. In other words, when we look at the Senate and we look at our state legislature, I should say, when we look at the Senate and the House of Representatives in Congress, technically, they're to represent and vote in a particular way that they've been elected to do. Now, when we look at the House of Representatives, the House of Representatives represent at this point in time 30,000 people. So it's really hard to get a consensus to make everybody happy. But if everybody uniformly demanded they vote a certain way, it would be in their own peril to choose to vote differently, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. But if it is so ambiguous that they basically say, hey, how can we can't discern that we don't have, you know, a real consensus on the numbers of how a vote for this, vote against this, because everybody's off, you know, with these other ideas and so forth. And so in the House of Representatives, it's hard to determine how to vote. In the state legislature, that's a very fixed number, a very small number. It's maybe 100 people. I think in New Hampshire, maybe 500 people. But in many states, it's somewhere between 100 and 200, usually not more than that. Some states are over that, but nevertheless, if the state legislature have a consensus regarding a treaty that is going to be voted upon by their senators, and they have a fixed, agreed, this is how we want them to vote, does the state legislature, having suffrage in the Senate, have the ability to tell their senators, you better vote this way?
No, they don't, because they answer to the people now.
No. So, you need to read the truth about the 17th Amendment. It's an article I wrote, and I sent it out. And I think this would be something you could probably chew on and just either put that out on. Because, folks, unbeknownst to you, Sean is very effectively working in the Patriot Movement, just like Tammy. And we can get into the details of state and across the states and so forth. But Sean has been working on educational stuff with me and others. And so we'll dive into this tomorrow when we come back, you know, about what Sean's doing. But if you can take the time, Sean, and take a look at the truth about the 17th Amendment, that would be great, because then you'll see the folly in what we've all interpreted the 17th Amendment to do. And B, bottom line is the states still have that guaranteed suffrage. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model, on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.